Good morning. Yeah, not too badly, you?
Yeah, cough again. Typical illness.
Always ill. That's what happens when I have so many kids.
I know, I'll be muting on and off while I hack my guts up in the background or have a drink of water or something. I've just been doing my machine rebooted again. I mean, it hasn't done it for a while, but I get this weird issue with my Mac where I sort of plug it in. I didn't use it last night, and I plug it back in, and it's saying, you know, you need to log in after a restart. And I'm like, oh, great. And then you go through that horrific restart process. The Mac does the same thing that Windows used to do, which I really hate. So when your machine is restarting and you've logged back in and, you know, everything's starting to fire up and appear and stuff, what I wish these systems would do is that whatever I am doing should override anything else. So if I'm trying to select a menu, or I'm trying to select an app to type in or something, because I was trying to do, you know, a search for the QuickTime player, that should take priority, yeah? But you're sort of in the middle of typing something, and then some other window pops up from some other app that's loading, and then that takes the focus. And it drives me crazy. Or you're, you know, trying to quit an app that's launching, and you're trying to right-click on its menu, and then something else is firing up. It just, you know, for these multitasking systems, even a Mac is just terrible at starting up.
You know what the problem there is that you've got too many things opening up.
Too many things. Yeah.
Mine launches in about 2 seconds because I have nothing.
Well, I think
open
what it was doing.
Default.
Well, I have cleaned up before, but I think what it was doing, because it never gave me the option. You know, when you log in, sometimes it gives you that really weird option of, do you want to load where you previously were?
And I hate that.
Yeah, and you sort of, if you say, I've never said normally say yes, so I just say cancel, and then it seems to still load some shit up. But you know, obviously loads your previous state. And I think that's what it was doing, but it never gave me the option. And the funniest thing was, you know, the report thing comes up. You know, do you want to report this to Apple? And normally I ignore that, but I said, okay, yep, I'll report it. And it comes up with some huge log normally, some huge, you know, exception report. It literally just said no data and then just said watchdog underneath, and that was it. It's like, great. So I don't even know what it was, but I've obviously
Isn't
got...
that a battery watchdog? Is that a battery problem? Like, did your laptop just die? I'm assuming
no,
you're talking about a laptop.
Well, it's not 100%. Yeah, it's on the MacBook. It's 100%. I don't know. It's something weird going on. I mean, I probably, you know, considering I upgrade pretty much every time a new MacBook Pro comes out, I would suggest it's probably old shit because I do the restore from Time Machine. So there's probably some shit on here that, you know, I haven't cleaned up, or if I probably did a fresh install of this machine, which I can't bear to do, it'll probably be fine. But maybe one day I've got to do that.
Yeah, anyway. It's frustrating.
Yeah, then Skype needed updating. Then call recorder wanted updating. It was like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's just constant Skype updates. Skype's a piece of shit. I mean, I don't think I've ever discussed this on this podcast before, but Skype is the absolute worst. I hate Skype, but I use it all the time because otherwise you end up using the Google Hangout, or I had to use a Facebook one a while ago. That's terrible. When I do games with my friend John, we tried using Discord, but then that didn't work for me. It just, the microphone didn't work for some reason. So I keep having to use Skype, but I absolutely detest it. I find it strange that there isn't a viable competitor to it. For things like voice in as well. It's not just the video calling, which you can do through other things. It's the fact that I want, you know, a landline number that goes through to it as well. And there are very, very few providers that do that. Very few.
Yeah, so I managed to... I've got a Skype in number. I used to have to use a London one because there was never one in my area. But I've managed to get one in the area now. So you can actually get my sort of... I think it's Andover. It's the nearest town. You can actually get a local code for this sort of region. So I've switched to that now. But what gets me is, you know, I've got a 300 plus meg internet connection with a sort of 20-odd meg upload. And you're still on a call with someone and it's crackly and crap and... It's just, yeah, it drives me crazy. But it's the latest Mac update that's shit, because Skype used to be, you know, a phone calling product. So you used to be able to launch Skype and you'd say, I'd like to make a phone call. And there'd be a dial pad and you'd click the button to make a call and it would come up with a dial pad and you'd dial the number or you'd pick a contact, whatever. It's simple. That was its core functionality. You load up the latest version, what was it, 8 or something when they launched it on the Mac. And it's basically trying to be like the iOS version. It's trying to be like Snapchat or something. It's just shit. You know, trying to find a dial pad. So I had to phone, who was I phoning? I was phoning PayPal about a payment. I'd sold a phone and they did this. I'll come back to this in a minute, but they did this stupid hold thing. So I was trying to phone their customer service. Just trying to launch Skype to make a phone call to a number was like the most horrific experience. You know, you have to, I can't do it now because I'm obviously in the call with you, I think. If I go back, I might be able to. Yeah. So, you know, it defaults to opening where you last were. So at the moment, it's loaded. I've got a huge list of recents on the left, and I've got you on the right because you're the one selected, your chat. So it's like, where do I make a call at this point? So there's a plus button in the corner, but if I hit that, that's actually adding another person into this call. So you have to look at the top of the screen, and then you've got like a little bell, a little contact book it looks like, and then a phone, what looks like a phone. So I think, okay, so if I press that now, I'm always concerned, like, well, I was concerned, if I press that, am I immediately calling you or am I hanging up this call? Because it's a phone. So, but it's a phone with a little, what looks like two little lines. So maybe, okay, it's a phone list or something. So I click that now. So I'm now clicking that. So now I get calls. So now I've got a list of recent calls, and then I get use dial pad as a tiny little option there. It's just, I just don't understand it. You know what I mean?
The thing I hate about Skype, I mean, the interface is, it reminds me of Google stuff. Like if I try and use Google Drive or Google Docs, I mean, I try not to, but for a few things I have to with other people. And I cannot understand for the life of me where the fuck anything is. Same with Google search. Like if I do an image search and then it's like, well, how do I choose that I want large images? Is it settings or is it search tools? Like there's just two buttons that are descriptively the same thing. And I always get the wrong one and then I have to go back and then click the other one.
Yeah.
Very, very strange interfaces there. Google Drive's the same. Like, I just click around. I've got no fucking clue where anything is. And Google Mail. And people go, oh, it's so great, Google. I love Google. iOS is so shit. And it's like, it's very strange. Skype's the same, though. I load it, and I've got no clue where anything is or how to use it. Like, if you would send me a message now, like a chat message, no clue how to get to it. I hear them come in sometimes, and it's well, I have to, like, mouse over, and then, like, a new, like, menu bit pops down, which could be there all the time, because we're not using video. Like, it wouldn't matter if you were using 44 pixels out of this huge display to actually keep that button on all the time. And then click that, and then it like appears in a little drawer at the side. But I don't know why it isn't always there by default. Anyway, I could go on for hours complaining about how shit Skype is. But
I've accidentally dialed people as well, just because the interface is so bad. You know, you sort of clicked on something, and suddenly you're calling them. And you know, with some of these in the old days, you know, a few years ago, when you used to dial something and accidentally used to be able to, you know, press stop and stop it. Nowadays, these connections go through so damn quickly. If you accidentally start dialing someone and quickly go, oh, shit, stop. You suddenly get a call back from them. Oh, I missed a call from you. Oh, great. You know, just user interface.
It leads me into a question, which is probably more relevant for freelancing, because despite this being a freelancing podcast, we very rarely talk about it, actually.
Yeah.
But how do you work with clients in terms of communications? Because for me, I mean, I will have a Skype call with people occasionally. if it's a new client and they want, you know, a phone call to talk through a project, then I'll do it. But I never have Skype running all the time. I just open it up, make the call that's at a prearranged time, and then I quit Skype because I never want people messaging me on there. if people message me or ring me or leave me voicemails there, I don't answer them. I tell them they have to get to me via email. And I used to have to use Slack for a few projects, but fortunately I don't have any that use that anymore. But that was the same. I used to turn notifications on, and I'd say to them, you're going to have to at Ben Dodson me, or better yet, email me if you need me urgently, because I know I've always got access to email, but I don't sit on Slack all the time waiting for you to chat to me, because it's not conducive to my work. So I pretty much have everything turned off, and I never give my clients my phone number. And if I have to ring from my mobile number to someone for whatever reason, then I always do the block my caller ID so they can't see. So I'm on the side of I have as little contact as possible that isn't done via email, which unusual, I think, for most freelancers. But I think you're the opposite end, where you have a phone line that's like available most of the time, and your chat option intercom on your website.
So I mean, I'm probably not as off the grid style as you in terms of phone calls and stuff. I mean, I don't like doing phone calls, and I don't like doing meetings. You know, I mean, a meeting here, if someone wants to come here for half an hour for a quick meeting, if it's like a If I've pre-qualified people, so, you know, the first process is I'll get, so I've got a thing on my website called Intercom, which is like the instant chat thing. It actually works really well, and I've actually got business through it, and it's paid for itself many times. But obviously you get crap as well, and I give people advice on that. So the typical thing I do for whatever scenario in terms of how an inquiry comes in is qualify them with a budget straight away. So, you know, if I've got that feeling that someone's a bit tire kicking and not really sure, and and they're not really giving me much information or anything about, you know, a spec or a budget, then I'll say, okay, look, this is a typical range of pricing. And that obviously eliminates anyone who thinks, you know, I had a guy the other day who wanted an app and thought 200 quid would cover it. You know, it's just incredible. I mean, it was literally incredible, you know, for the stuff that he wanted. And it was like, I've got an API, I've got all this stuff, couple hundred quid cover it. It's like, right, okay. So, you know, that's the sort of qualification I'll do. So if someone says, can we have a quick call, you know, or can I call you, or, you know, can you call me back or whatever? The first thing I'll do is reply, if it's an email or intercom or whatever, saying, you know, qualifying it first. I don't want to have a phone call with someone to find out they've got 200 quid.
Likewise, I do exactly the same thing.
And likewise, I don't want them to come, you know, can we have a coffee? Can I come to your office? Well, no. You know, and I'll literally go back, you know, firstly, can we just talk about budgets and things? This is what you should be expecting. And as soon as they say that's in line with what I'm talking about, great, let's have a phone call. That's fine. So I don't mind doing that stuff. And obviously, I've got a phone number on my website, so I will get calls. But I will reject calls sometimes if I'm busy and I'm in the middle of something. I'll reject the call. I'm not going to suddenly just jump at answering the phone, because my voicemail says, all my voicemails basically say, email's the best way to get hold of me. So please email me at, you know, hell at bouncingfish, Jason at bouncingfish, whatever. So email is pretty much the primary way that I'd like to talk to people. And one of the reasons for that is, I know, yes, you can use call recorder and things like that, but obviously you should be telling people if you're recording calls, but sometimes you don't. But I like that record because, A, I've got a lot of things going on and my memory is then crap. And so I want to be able to refer back to things. So email's always good because I want that record. I do use Slack because I'm in certain Slack groups for some of the stuff I do and also for some clients. And that's mainly sometimes, even though Slack can be a bloody nightmare and, you know, takes 200 meg up per workspace you're in.
Yeah.
You know, you literally got an app running that uses a gigabyte of memory. I do that sometimes because sometimes it allows me to circumvent the calls and everything else that people want to do. Do you know what I mean? I can bring the client and their three people together into a Slack, and then I can just send one message and they all get it, and it's nice and clear. So I try and avoid the calls as much as possible, but sometimes you have to. But I see it just like these meetings, you know, these unnecessary meetings that you get in companies and corporates, where it's like, and the worst ones, which I do get when you deal with agencies and deal with some clients, where they'll say, okay, we've got a call tomorrow with XYZ. Can we have a call beforehand to discuss what we're going to talk about on the call?
Oh,
and you're like, we're literally having a meeting, a pre-meeting to the meeting, which I've already said and thought is pointless anyway. It's just that stuff literally drives me crazy. So there's a couple of things that are funny.
If it's billable time, it's fine.
Yeah. So there's a thing that's going on. Well, there's two things at the moment. I've got a client that I'm not really fully working for yet, because the idea was I was going to start working for them to develop this app, and then they had to go back and do some redesign stuff. And this is a classic example of too much method of communication. So firstly, I was getting emails updating me on their progress with the designs. Great. Fine. Thanks. You know, basically, I'm not doing anything until you give me the final design. So you tell me when they're ready and then I'll start looking at it. But they wanted me to have a look at some user interfaces and make sure everything was okay, whatever. So that's fine. Next minute, I'm added to a WhatsApp group. So I'm now added to a WhatsApp group with them, their designers and stuff. And literally last night, I was looking through my phone. I'm seeing a bubble on WhatsApp. Oh, I'll just check that, whatever. Click on WhatsApp. Oh, there's a message from them asking about a tab bar height. So I've just replied with yes, and that's that. So eventually I said, okay, can we just get a Slack set up, because that's going to be the best way to do this. I can't be dealing with Skype, Slack, phone calls, emails. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and they're the sort of clients that will send you an email and they go, can we have a call to discuss? It's like, well, you've just told me everything in the email. We don't need to discuss. And I've literally had meetings with people before where they've said, and especially with agencies where you're dealing with digital project managers, who is another whole other story I can't really talk about. Well, I could talk about, but I won't talk about now. Where you know, you send them an update on what you've been working on or what you're doing, or you update a ticket to say what the status is, and then they want to have a meeting to discuss progress, and they'll go, so how are you doing? Well, I put it all in the ticket. It's all there. And well, yeah, but how you know, so what's that? So I literally read the ticket message out to them on the phone as the update. And that just drives me crazy, drives them crazy, and I end up not working with them again. But so that's what that it's the unnecessary nonsense. And you know what it's like, you know, when you're coding, and this gets lots of criticism. I remember working for companies where I was a development manager, and the developers always used to get shit for this, by saying, you know, don't interrupt me. You know, when you come over to me and interrupt me, it really throws me off, and I have to take half an hour to get back to what I was doing. And it's really easy for people, especially digital project managers, because I remember one who used to say this all the time. Oh, that's a load of crap, because, you know, you'll stop what you're doing and go on Twitter, or you'll stop what you're doing and do this, or you'll stop what you're doing and have a coffee. And it's like, yeah, but you don't understand that
choosing your point to start not being interrupted mid-flow.
Exactly. When we choose, you know, when I choose to take a break and play a video game or do whatever, I have chosen a natural stop point to which I can walk away from and come back to. But if I'm in the middle, I used to equate it years ago to being, you know, in a room taking an engine apart or something. You know, you've taken an engine apart, or you've taken something really complicated apart, and you've laid everything out in the room, and you've got everything where you want it, and you know where everything is, and you know what you're doing. And then some asshole walks into the room and just walks through it all. Maybe one of your children walks through and just scatters everything. And now you've got to spend time, after you've got rid of them, putting everything back in the right place again. And that's what it feels like. You know, when I am one of these developers who can very easily be in the middle of a bit of code, refactoring it completely unnecessarily and breaking it. You know, it is now broken, and I'm barely trying to understand my own code that I wrote 2 days ago. And I'm really right. I'm in the zone of just.
Jason is available at bouncingfish.com for all new contracts.
Yeah. Exactly. And I'm barely understanding my own code. I'm getting back into the zone. I'm just about to fix this thing. I'm just about to do this thing and unbreak what I've just done to rewrite the damn thing. And then a phone call comes in, or an interruption happens, and you are completely thrown then. And when you come back to it, you know, I've gone back to code after a week, and I've refactored a bit of code, or looked at a bit of code I've done, and thought, what the hell have I done that if statement for? That doesn't make any sense. And then I've removed it, and then I've run the app, and something hasn't worked, and I've gone, ah, I know exactly why I did that. And it's because there's just so much going on, and you're trawling through all this code, and it's easy for us to take a break and have a coffee. You've probably done the same thing. You know, you solve a problem, you fix something, you upload an app, you do something, and then you take a break, and you can come back, and then you can pick it up again. So it is really, really hard, and I do get clients that go on Skype, and they'll message me on Skype, and they expect a bloody instant response. And I'll either ignore it, or I'll say, can you email me? Because this isn't the place to have that conversation, you know?
I always equate that kind of interruption thing with, imagine that you're trying to count people, like for a school trip or something, and you're counting it.
Yes.
And then someone comes up behind you and just starts going, 5, 3, 2,
yes,
7, yes, 9. That's what happens when you interrupt a developer, and they have to start again.
Yeah.
From the beginning, because you can't just go, oh yeah, I was at number 9, and then turn and look, and all the people are moving, and then go back and carry on where you were.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
and that's also a perfect analogy of what a digital project manager is like. Because while you're counting the kids onto the bus, they come up and go, hi, just wanted to get a status on getting everyone on the bus and ready for the trip. Yeah, I'm in the middle of getting them on the bus. That's what I'm doing now. Okay, so when do you think that will be done? Because I've just got to update everybody. It's like, I'm doing it right now. You're stopping me from doing it. I've got to get everybody back off now to recount them because you're interrupting me. You know,
I think a project manager can exactly be described as surplus to requirement in most scenarios. They are generally completely not useful at all and have no training in anything that they're talking about. And it's hilarious because they have to interface with a client, sort of say, oh yeah, the developer's doing this. And the client will ask like a technical question. They'll be like, oh, I don't know, I'd have to ask them. And then they come and ask the developer a stupid question. And you're just like, just get someone who fucking knows what they're talking about to deal with these people. I hate agencies. I hate working for them. I hate everything about them. Bloody awful.
The sort of digital project manager role it's come from that thing, if you imagine, like, so I'm, you know, I work for myself, I work by myself, as you do. We have to deal with clients. You have your way of dealing with them, and I have my way of dealing with them.
very short shrift they get from me.
yeah. And I could see a point where if I was like the old days of Bouncing Fish, where we had a team, which is exactly what we did. We had a team of developers, and I couldn't manage everybody because I was out trying to get business as well and doing other stuff and dicking around and doing whatever and getting everyone else to do the work, which was nice. So I got a project manager in because I don't want to be dealing with the shit from the clients. I don't want to be dealing with all the silly questions and all the calls and everything else. And so you hire. So that's where they come from. They come from that need to have someone as a buffer to say, I don't want to be pestered all the time. Can you deal with it? And I'll let you know when things are going to be ready. And then, of course, because you've hired someone to do that role, rather than just accept the fact that that person's probably going to not have much to do most of the time, it's that, well, we need to justify that position. So therefore, can you just do some Gantt charts and do all kinds of projections. I mean, I remember when we first went contracting in 2000, when we left our job. So Hannah and I met at a company in London doing programming. She actually was she's a C++, an old school, you know, VB, C++, C# developer, proper developer, you know, properly educated developer, computer science, the whole works. And I'm a sort of fell into it developer. So we met at a consultancy firm, and then I was there for like 4 years. She was there for about a year and a half. And then we decided to leave and go contracting. And the first job we got was contracting for a company called March 1st. It was US Web CKS. And they became March 1st, and they were, you know, one of these companies that spent a fortune on branding exercises, hired the Wall Street Journal to reveal their rebrand in this weird print that you could only see, this print that went every day for a week, full page print in the Wall Street Journal. I'm digressing, but it's a funny story. And they used this weird, you know, remember those Magic Eye pictures?
Yeah.
Where you sort of, the first time you stood there for an hour, and then you finally saw the frigging dinosaur, and after that you could see every single one. Every single one instantly, you know, every single one was like, oh yeah, it's a UFO, it's a bloody lollipop. But that first one was like, holy shit, why can't I see this bloody dinosaur? So once you've cracked that, so yeah, that was the trick they used. But you had to wear these glasses. And if you wore these glasses, a bit like 3D glasses, it would filter and show the word, show these clues. Which, I mean, why anybody would give a shit what you'd rebranded to is another thing. But anyway, so this was a 5-day exercise. Probably cost them $1 million to do this. anyway, they screwed the printing up, so you could read it without the damn glasses for like 4 days or three or five days. So the whole thing was just complete nonsense. But anyway, we worked for this company and we were doing a contract through them. So we were hired as contractors and we were working for the NSPCC, sponsored by Microsoft, to develop a portal for kids called what was it called? It was part of the Green Dot or whatever it was campaign, you know, the safety campaign. So it was like a agony aunt type forums, and it was all very secure, and you had to be careful, obviously, for obvious reasons. There was an agony aunt column and all these different things. And we started, and it was an ASP, classic ASP website. So Hannah was writing the back end in ASP. It wasn't .NET. It was like she was writing like DLLs and things and libraries that I would then write the front end web stuff that would invoke that. And basically, we had this project manager who I can't remember his name, but we called him Tim Nice But Dim. I think his name was Tim, but we literally referred to him as Tim Nice But Dim. Hopefully he's never going to listen to this. But anyway, but he was hysterical because he was literally surplus to requirements. And all he wanted to do was Gantt charts. And, God, you know, I'm the sort of person that if I say to a client, okay, this is going to take 6 weeks, it's going to take 5 weeks development, whatever. I'm pretty confident that's going to take 5 or 6 weeks. But I can't tell you what I'm going to be doing on Wednesday afternoon of the fourth week. I couldn't tell you that in 2000 when we were both, you know, single with no children. I definitely can't tell you that now when I'm married working at home with 5 children. I probably can't tell you what I'm doing this afternoon, you know. it can change any minute. So when you've got someone whose job it is to produce Gantt charts and literally wants to know when you're going to be working on the registration component or something, and I end up saying to them, just like I say to people now, if I get any client who says to me, can you provide us some sort of schedule, I'll say to them, I can make a schedule up for you where I will take all the components of the app as a sort of top level and give you some sort of schedule. But I am literally making the dates up because you've asked me to within that development period.
Yeah.
So just because I've said I'm working on the login doesn't mean I might be working on the login this week. I might be working on that next week. Things change, you know, just the way things get developed changes the way you do it as you're doing it.
Yeah, so this is why I tell my clients, I won't give them anything concrete. I'll just say, this is when you'll get the first draft. This is when you'll get the second one. That's the dates. But I'm not going to get into timesheets or telling you exactly what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. In an ideal world with my clients, I speak to them once every 2 weeks, and that's when I've got something to show them when some work's done. Now, some of the time, I do all that work in the 2 days before that point. Sometimes I spread it out over the full 2 weeks.
Yeah,
they don't care as long as it gets done. Because I also don't work on a time basis, because that's stupid. So as long as stuff gets done at the point I say it is, everyone's happy. But I refuse to entertain the idea of real-time communication with clients. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you can, and I mean, I probably need to get better at this in terms of my email communication, but you can sort of forego any of the project management ability that you think you need or a client thinks you need just by basically being proactive with them. So like with certain clients now, at the beginning of the week, I'll just say, this is what I'm working on this week, and this is what to expect from me at the end of the week. And once I've sent that email, that's it. because all these people want most of the time, it's just like us. It's just like me when I've got a burst pipe at the moment that means our outside water is not working because it's only a tiny little puncher because of the cold. So I'm, you know, contacting a plumber. He said he could pop by yesterday, but he hasn't managed to do it yet. And I, as a person who just wants that done, all I really want from him is, you know, when are you coming? So I don't care if it's today, tomorrow, next week. Just give me a day. As long as you come on that day, I don't mind because I know you're coming on that day. And that's all these people want, really. They just want to have some sort of progress update. And it's easy for people like me and developers to sort of close themselves away and not send that message, not be proactive, and then just be reactive all the time to the client. You know, so suddenly the client's going, oh, how's it going? Oh, shit, I've got to get a response. What do I say? What do I say?
Oh, whereas shit, I've not started it yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm in the middle of architecting the back end. You know, there's nothing.
Oh, can I see it? Can you show me the database schema?
Buy yourself a couple of weeks.
Shit.
Exactly. Well, no, I say this, but when this is a good story. So when I worked for this consultancy that Hannah and I met, it was called DPR Consulting, still going. It was a ASP, Microsoft house, .NET. They now do lots of, I think they do like financial software and things now. But we used to do things like document management using Eastman products, and it was using Outlook forms to do document management. It was pretty cool. We did
Sounds
things.
Lovely.
We worked for the cabinet office and went into number 10 and all this stuff. But the boss I had, Dave, was the funniest guy. He was an incredible bluffer. So, and he would purposefully do things, not in a horrible way. It wasn't like I don't want to say this in like he was bullying or anything, but he would just put you on the spot. He'd love to put you on the spot almost to see how you react to it. Mm. And we went to a meeting once, and I was doing technical sales for them. So I was helping him write, I was writing code, but it was really for like demos and proof of concepts. So I would proof of concept something, and then we'd win the business, and then it would be like, development team, you just got to deliver what we've just said I could do. So they'd go off and do it. And we did this, and this demo we used to do, which thinking back of it now is so funny. We used to go with this like travel suitcase. You know, the travel suitcase was a laptop, a monitor, just in case they didn't have anything, a scanner, and all the power cables and everything we need. And we'd go in and we'd set it all up, and we'd be demoing how they could take documents, scan them, use this online software to skip through the fields on the forms and automatically, you know, input details, and it would all log it into these Outlook forms and everything. And we went into one client, and we did not have a product yet. We didn't have a working demo. And he walked in without this bag, without all this stuff, and basically said, yeah, we've got this product, we've got this solution, we want to show you it. I mean, we can show it if you want. We've got it in the car. You know, Jason can go and get it, and we can bring it in and show it to him. And I'm literally looking at him like, what the hell are you saying? What the hell are you doing?
What's going to happen if they say yes?
Yeah, and he's like, so Jason, you know, what do you think? Should we do that? And I said, Dave, we could do that. I don't think they need to see it right now. I don't think this is the right time for them to see it. I think we need to establish, you know, what they're doing and how they're doing things at the moment.
God.
He's like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, I think you're right. And I'm like, you utter shit. it was that sort of stuff. I used to enjoy that sort of stuff. It was quite fun. It was like years ago, I had to do a demo of AutoCAD in the States. I was doing this in the 90s, the early 90s, I had to travel the States for 3 months selling this AutoCAD software. And I remember doing a presentation to these people, 40 people in a room, of this AutoFM, it was called. It was this space planning software that used AutoCAD. And it was quite flaky. I mean, we had some issues with it. And I remember you're using command line stuff, really, in AutoCAD. Everything was pretty much command line in AutoCAD. And I typed something, and then the whole system crashed, and I went straight to the DOS prompt. and the whole room sort of went silent, and I went, and that's our express to DOS option. everyone starts laughing and everything, and people were coming up to me afterwards going, nicely handled. It was like, Christ. But yeah, so yeah, it was always fun. But yeah, I mean, I can't remember what we were talking about when I went off subject.
Project managers and why they're useless.
Project managers, yeah, but that was it. I mean, that's what I try and do now is basically, I don't want to give people schedules, but I'll give them a rough guide of, you know, what to expect after a couple of weeks, what to expect after 4 weeks, whatever. And then basically just keep them updated with an email every week, and that's it. And it just keeps them, you know, from emailing, because what will happen is they'll email, you don't respond in 3 hours or something, so they'll phone you, and all you're doing is setting yourself up to get pestered all the time. But that's pretty much how I try and work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just generally fairly aggressive with clients and just tell them, look, I'm not here to be contacted all the time. The thing will get done. And as long as I deliver it when I say I'm going to, then everyone's happy.
But, well, exactly.
Yeah. I'm working with a company at the moment. I'm doing like a consultancy where they're getting an app developed by a big agency. And I've just been hired as a middleman to basically help the client know when the agency's talking bullshit. Do an awful lot because they're a big agency. And they had, in our first meeting with them, 10 people on their side. And I was like, see, this is why it's costing you three times as much as it would if you just got a freelancer to do this. Because you've got 10 bodies in a room and 9 of them are not required. And then, funny enough, 2 of them we talked about quite a lot were utterly useless. Just asked the most insipid questions that weren't their business. Like, they would just sort of say, oh, I don't understand why you're doing this for this business reason. And it's like, well, we understand the business reason. You don't, because you know nothing about business because you're fresh out of bloody university or something with a English degree or God knows what. And then they got fired a couple of weeks later. Apparently it had been on the cards for a while. And it's like, oh, Jesus Christ. But very strange.
Sort of stuff, that sort of stuff just drives me... It drives me crazy. And and you've got the extremes of, and we might as well talk about this Upwork experience I've got at the moment.
Oh, that's good. Good segue. Because, beautiful.
Yeah, because, you know, you get customers. I mean, I've dealt with customers and I deal with customers that I'm doing a massive project at the moment for somebody that's a big publishing platform. And it's a very difficult thing to show them progress because you're working on a lot of back-end API stuff. You're documenting an API. You're writing a lot of business logic in the API. But they want to see, they obviously want to see some stuff. So we were writing like an editor and a very simple web interface demo that was showing writing content and things like that. Because obviously they're giving you lumps of money. And it's like, well, I'm giving you lumps. It's like, you know, paying a builder lumps of money. And then, you know, where's the building? You know, I want to see something. Even if it's a bloody 10 people digging a foundation, I want to see that something's going on.
Which, interrupt you very briefly, with this agency at the moment, they turned around the other day and said, oh, yeah, we'll have something to show you soon, something to show you. And then on a call yesterday, they were like, oh, we've only done the login pages and stuff at the moment, so you probably don't really need to see them because there's not that much there. And I was like, show them to me because I want to make sure they're done. And you can almost, I can almost imagine someone frantically actually creating that page now. It probably wasn't done.
Yeah, hold on, the line's a bit crackly. Hold on.
Yeah, you want to see it now? Oh, okay, well, they've just popped out and we need access to GitHub for it. So I'll get that over to you tomorrow, but they are working on it.
Fire alarm goes off. Hold on, we've got to leave it. We'll be back in a minute. Yeah.
Get Junior quick.
So you get the extremes of... And I've had, I was talking about this to somebody, who was I talking about this to yesterday? A client who, you know, the micromanager clients. So I had a client, it was a .NET project that had come up, which is unusual for me. I mean, I have it on the website, but I don't really get those inquiries anymore. And it was for a product for electrical companies. It was all about reporting and customer, you know, energy monitoring and energy bills and things like that. And obviously this guy's licensed this software to energy providers and makes a lot of money. But he doesn't know anything about coding, and so he gets other people to do it for him. But so he said, you know, are you interested? I said, yeah, fine. I mean, you know, send me the code so I can set it all up and get it all working, and then send me what the fixes are you need doing, and I'll work through them. No. His way of working was that he wanted to do a webcam thing in real time to go, and this leads me into this Upwork thing, to go through everything as you're doing it. And and it was, yes. And I was talking to someone yesterday. It was a designer who's helping me on this project, and it was, I equated it to him like, you know, when you're trying to do technical support for your family, you're trying to work on their laptop or their computer or their Apple TV, whatever it is.
Trying to explain to your mum what an email signet is.
Well, you're just trying to fix something. You're trying to do something on the machine. And then for some reason, like, you might go, oh, and they go, oh, what's wrong? It's okay. I may make grunting, sighing, and other noises while I'm doing this. It doesn't mean there's anything to worry about. You know what I mean?
I do my best Tim Allen impression while I'm giving you support.
But that's what it was like working for this guy. So I would have to be on a shared screen thing. We'd be sharing code. I'd be sharing him into my code using whatever software he wanted to use. Nothing that was actually any good. And then we would be in real time going through the fixes. And I'd be trying to do the fixes for him. And he'd be going, oh, what are you doing there? What's that bit there? And it's like, can you just please go? And I did a couple of sessions with him, and then I was just like, I'm done. I can't do this. And that was clearly one of these examples of someone who distrusts people so much that he has to sit over your shoulder and watch you do the work. And recently, I've never dealt with this Upwork service before. I've heard of them. There's people per hour. There's all these shit services where basically they're a broker, and they're creaming a little bit off your fees and giving you some stupid contract that says, terms and conditions that once you've worked for us with that client, you can't work for them direct. You know, the typical bullshit. Yeah.
Good luck managing that.
Yeah. So anyway, I had a client who came through Twitter, needed some help with some titanium stuff, talked to them about rates. up my rate, which was quite nice, because I just decided to change it. And they were fine with that. But they said, you know, have you got international? Because I like prepayments with certain, especially when I'm starting with new clients, I get a prepayment of working.
Oh, yeah.
Deposit or whatever, especially if it's American.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So they say, oh, no, we don't normally do that. So that's fine. We don't have to work together. You know, so that's not me being an arsehole. Well, it is me being an arsehole, but it's me. I don't need the work. But if you want to work,
I'm exactly the same. If someone says, we don't usually do that, I say, well, I don't usually work for people that don't pay me a deposit. So,
yeah, exactly.
I guess we're in a standoff.
Yeah. So they were like, fine. Okay. But how can we pay you? And I said, well, here's my bank details. I've got Swift. I've got, IBAN and all the international stuff. It's all there. Well, normally we work through Upwork, so can we do that? It's like, okay, fine.
No.
So I've already got for some reason I've got an old Upwork account, so I log in.
I always like to think, details. Jason, that most of your problems that you bring to this podcast can be solved by my key tenet of any freelance negotiation, which is the word no.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we pay you via Upwork? No.
So the first thing I have to do is up my rate even more, because Upwork take 20%. So I'm like, I'm not losing 20%. I know. Jesus. And this is their choice. And this is the crazy. What will come out of this is the craziness of it is that they are only doing this because it's what they're used to doing. And they've even admitted now that we shouldn't really be doing this because.
Did you tell them that you are upping your rate by 20%?
Yes.
To cover the 20%.
I said I had to up the rate to do this. And it's not their fault. It's the way. Well, you know, you could argue it is, but it's the way they work. Right. So it's the way their accounting team are used to working. So what Upwork are benefiting from.
But I always find it funny that companies that have an accounting team are always the ones that are least flexible in anything financial.
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're paying a team of financial specialists to save you money, yet you end up doing something horrendously expensive because that's what they're used to doing and they refuse to do anything else.
Exactly. So this then leads us into how Upwork works. So I'm thinking, okay, if this is how you want to pay me, fine. If that's what's going to work for you, fine. I'd rather you did it the other way, but that's fine. Whatever. Then I start looking into how Upwork works. And basically, it's the worst possible solution to – I'm trying to think of the right thing to say here. So, okay, home working and remote working. The biggest misconception and assumption is that you're ripping the client off. You're ripping your boss off. You're sitting at home playing video games and dicking around and not doing the work. That's because you're not being valued on what you're delivering and you're being valued on time, which is just nonsense, you know, because people could be more productive than others and all that bullshit. To me, as long as you're getting the work done, I don't care how many hours you work. And if you can if you can do a 4-hour day and instead of an 8-hour day and do the same work as an 8-hour day, I'd like you to teach me how to do that. You know, I don't want you to do double and do more work. I want you to teach me how to do the same because you've done 8 hours of work in 4 hours. That's genius, you know? So Upwork is basically allowing those people who are the worst possible clients to work for. And I'm not saying these guys are because they're not doing what I'm about to talk about by any means. It allows them to monitor what you're doing. So the way Upwork works, the way I'm working with this customer is completely different. So I'm doing, I'm not doing timesheets with
Upwork. You're just doing the payments piece, aren't you?
Yeah. So what I have to do is I have to log time with Upwork, but it's called manual time and it's not, air quotes, protected by their payment system. But that's fine. I don't care because I'm getting a prepayment. And the way they're having to pay me is through a bonus payment, which is how they have to do it. So they have to issue a bonus payment. And then I just log hours, which are just bullshit, not bullshit hours, but you know what I mean? They don't mean anything. I'm just logging it as a record. So that's fine. And you know, that's fine. They're not doing anything wrong in that sense. But the way Upwork normally works is that you have to install a piece of software on your machine.
No.
Which is their timesheet tracking thing. Okay. And then you have to. So this is like the most fundamental misunderstanding of how a developer works, right? So then you have to say, right, I am now going to do some coding on this project. And like a lawyer, you know, hit the start button. And now I'm coding on this project. And then a phone call comes in for something else. Uh-oh, I've got to pause and then do the phone call and then go back. And I'm working on this project again, which is terrible anyway, because, you know, you don't do that. You forget to do that. Everything goes wrong, whatever. What's worse is that periodically Upwork will take screenshots of your machine.
I was going to say...
To your timesheet. Exactly. So during the period where you're logging, let's say you bring, and this is just the worst thing, not only for security and privacy and everything else. I mean, what happens when I'm in the middle of coding for that client and I happen to drag into the window that's captured, whether it's the whole damn screen or whatever, my banking information, because I need to check my bank quickly. You know, and you should have stopped recording. Shut up. No, nobody does that. Nobody does that at work when they're full-time job. Nobody does that. You know, you don't have a stopwatch. You don't have a chess clock, chess watch thing on your desk where you stop and start the damn thing. You know, project manager comes up. Hold on. Ding. Yes. How can I help you? Ding. Right. Back on the other thing. It doesn't work like that, right?
That's crazy.
So, yeah. So so there was no way I would ever do that anyway. So I'd be like, yeah, I'm not doing that.
No chance in hell. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, you would expect people just to leave it running and just leave up Xcode window and just leave it running overnight and just be like, yep, I worked 8 hours last night when they did nothing. But I guess if it's taking screenshots, you can see that it hasn't changed.
Exactly. So that's that bullshit. So that's the one thing, is that developers don't work like that. Okay, we don't operate in that fixed time zone on one particular thing necessarily. The second thing is if you do manual time, if I log manual time in Harvest, which is the tool I normally use, I basically go in, I say 4 hours, what were you doing? I was doing this, log it against my project. And I just do that for my own benefit to track time, just so I know about productivity and all that sort of crap. And I've got guys that help me out with stuff as well, so I need to be able to track things as well with that. That's simple, yeah? You could just go in, you can go into the weekly view, you could just do 2, 2, 2, 2 per day, whatever. With this thing, when you do manual entry, you have to say what time you started and what. So if I want to log 4 hours, I literally just say 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. or something, yeah? And it logs that time. And then yesterday I was doing it and I made a mistake. Something happened and I think I put in 12 a.m. or did something wrong. You know, or no, I put an extra hour. I put 12 till 6 instead of 12 till 5 or whatever. So I went back in to correct it, thinking all I've got to do is hopefully just change the number of hours. Worst case, all I've got to do is change the 12 till 6 to a different time, to 12 till 5. No. When I go in to edit it, I see 12, half 12, 1, half 1. Loads of entries all the way up to 6 p.m. And I have to select all of them and then update the notes for all of them to be the same. Because they think that for some reason developers work in these half an hour increments.
It's is that because they do billing by half an hour increments? Retarded, but...
Christ, no. But that, okay, so that's one problem. That's one problem. The second problem is how they pay you. So once the client has made a prepayment, it takes, for some reason, this is a prepayment. This hasn't got to be verified by the client. It's not a timesheet that has to be paid. They have paid money to you via Upwork, just like PayPal.
Yeah.
That goes into your account on the Monday. You can't draw that. You can't get that into your account for another week. So while they're earning interest on all that money that's going in for all these different people.
And taking the 20% off it.
Yeah. So then after a week, and they've made 20% already, you then withdraw the funds. And I didn't get told I could withdraw it. I didn't get an email. I didn't get a notification of any kind. Didn't get anything through the desktop app. So I had to go to the website and say, is this money available yet? Oh, yes, it is. You can withdraw it. Great. I'm going to withdraw it and get charged £2.99 or something, even though they've taken 20%.
Oh, my God.
So
you
then
get charged for withdrawing your money?
Yeah. Yep. So the bank details are now in. So it's submitted. Thank you for submitting the withdrawal. I'm thinking, okay, it's coming. It's an American company. It's not going to be like over here where if I pay you money, it's in your account almost immediately or within 2 hours, but usually immediately. So I'll give them the benefit that it's going to be, you know, a couple of days, whatever. No. I get an email 2 days later saying it'll be another week until the money is paid into my account. So they basically can sit on your money for 2 weeks. And this is money that hasn't been.
That's longer than my payment terms. My payment terms are 7 days.
Yeah. I know. Same as mine for most stuff. And if it's a deposit, it's like 2 days. It's like 24 hours, 3 days, whatever, you know. But that just drives me crazy. And then yesterday I was messaging them saying, apparently the customer, because what had happened is for some reason the client had made a mistake. They'd actually paid the prepayment. And then because I had to log the hours, they accidentally paid for those hours as well. So there's sort of a credit to work off.
Okay.
But that second payment isn't showing in my account. Right. And so I message Upwork, and the client's like really concerned and saying, well, you know, do you want to see the credit card statement? I'm like, look, you know, I'm not making a huge deal of it. I trust the fact that you've paid it. You know, we've worked together for a week or whatever, and I trust that you've paid money already, and you don't know me from Adam. So, you know, I trust you. So I'm chasing it up with Upwork, and I'm being told, oh, you know, you get the shitty responses on Twitter going, oh, have a look at our new user experience guides over here. Well, you know. You really shouldn't need guides to explain new users how to use this system if it was bloody simple. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm logging in and they're telling me to go to my transaction history. The transaction history doesn't show me anything to do with a payment because they sent an automated invoice. When I created the hours, they sent this invoice to the client, you see, which I wasn't aware, you know, because they don't send me a copy. I don't get a copy saying we've sent – if I use Xero to send an invoice to a client, it sends me a copy. I can see that. A statement goes out, it sends me a copy of the statement. I see a record in my email of everything that goes out. I don't see that with this. This is what bothers me about it. It's all pull, pull, pull. It's not push, you know. It's the old – it's fetch, basically. It's fetch communication. So then they say – so I go back in and I say, look, I am not seeing anything in my account that says there are pending funds. Nothing that says this invoice has been paid by credit card. Nothing that says there's pending funds. Oh, no, you need to go – if you look at your dashboard, it says there's this much money in review. Well, what does that mean? So I go to that page and it says this much money in review. Okay, click the little I button next to it. In review means that your hours have been submitted to the client and they have a week to review your hours to then pay you. But they've already – yeah, they've already paid. Exactly. So all of this comes down to, A, we're going to take 20%, and B, we're going to sit on your money as long as possible to get whatever – to eke whatever interest rate we can get out of it. Can you imagine if they're doing this for, you know, I hope not a million, but, you know, 100,000 developers – and there's $1,000 or something per 100,000 developers. Even, you know, with small percentages of interest, that's a good chunk of money for 2 weeks. So it's just bullshit. It just – and it I will never use it again. And I'm only using it with this client because they want to. And they've even said to me, we shouldn't have bothered doing this because it's just costing us. And I was like, yeah. But it's just very, very frustrating. I hate these sort of services.
I had to use Coworks once for a client because that's how they did everything. But they upfront said, we'll – I think they knew one of the guys that ran it, and he set my account up for me. They didn't have to go through any verification bull. And they sorted it all out so that I got paid quicker than they usually do, because I said, I'm only using it if it goes with my payment terms, which is 7 days. And they were like, oh, well, it goes through like a 30-day process, like you're saying with Upwork. So I was like, well,
yeah,
I'm sorry, I'm not going to work with you. I'm happy to use whatever payment system you want, but it's going to have to pay me in my payment frame. Which is what I say to big corporates as well, when they're like, oh, sorry, well, our things, we only do like 30 days or 60 days because that's how our account team work. And I say, well, if you've got a fucking account team, I'm sure that they can actually process a payment quicker than a snail's pace. If a little tiny startup with a load of guys who are actually busy, you know, doing something, if you've got accountants sitting idle, I'm sure they can make a payment. And if they say no, then I don't work with them. It's very, very rare that I work with anyone that doesn't pay me in 7 days.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing with Upwork is when you actually sign up for them, because I've heard stories of people not getting accepted by Upwork as a developer because they've got too many developers like you. But one of the things that happened when I signed up was that I had to put – you have to put your skills in, and you put – you know, because I work with JavaScript, I put JavaScript and all this bullshit. So after I've done my profile and I've linked to my Twitter account and I've linked to my LinkedIn and I've linked to my Facebook – and all of my user accounts pretty much are Jason Neen. So Skype is Jason Neen, LinkedIn, Facebook, all that, all my short URLs are all the same name. There can be no doubt that when you link these things together and look at them all, that it's me, right? There's very little verification that's required there, yeah? Because everything's connected. Yeah. I get this message from them saying, your account's on hold currently, pending an interview we need to do with you.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I'm like, are you serious? You know, basically,
don't use your bloody system.
Yeah. I am trying to sign up to your service to give you 20%. What is the problem? You know? Yeah. So then I have to have this call. So this call comes in. We have a question for you. Could you, you work with JavaScript. So are you familiar with jQuery? Yes. So are you familiar, you know, what can you tell me about this aspect of jQuery or whatever it was? I'm like, nothing. I know what jQuery is. I've may have played with it a couple of times, but it's not what I use in my job. I don't understand the relevance of this question. It's like, remember when, you know, the days when you used to deal with agents with tech jobs, and I remember walking down Lavender Hill in London when we were first looking for work, I think it was in 2000, and I'd get a call. I got a call from an agent, you know, clearly somebody on the end of the phone who has no effing clue about coding, who is reading from a crib sheet they've been given from the client that says, you know, do you know what response.write does in ASP?
Oh my God.
And you're sort of like, are you serious? Has the client actually given you this as a question to ask me? Honestly.
I have never been in a situation where someone has asked me a technical question, either at interview or for a contract. And if someone I would just say, no. I might answer, but I would be, you know... I don't see the relevance of it in most things. Like the most relevant question is, do you know how to use Google and Stack Overflow?
Exactly. I mean, I would love, I mean, based on how old and cranky and, you know, annoying I am now, I'd love to be in that situation where you go into an interview and they bring up a whiteboard and say, can you draw us a, you know, bubble sorting diagram? I'm like, no, no, I'm not going to tell you how to do bubble sorting or anything like that. A, because I didn't give a shit and probably don't know how to do it. And I just don't care. It's not relevant. Like, it's absolutely not relevant.
Always reminds me of when you go for a like a project meeting, like when you're meeting a new client for the first time or they're a prospective client, and they sort of say to you, oh, you've used it right. What would you say we should do to improve it? And I always just look at them with a little wry smile and say, well, if you pay me, you know, for 5 days' work, then I'd be happy to give you a little report on what you can do to improve it. I can see lots of things that are wrong with it. You've got all kinds of problems here, but I'm not going to tell you what they are for free because, you know, that's my business. That's kind of what you're going to pay me for. And they're like, oh, yeah, fair enough.
But exactly. And that also comes down to an email. This is another little segue into an email I got the other day, which was funny, about NDAs, because this drives me crazy. NDAs.
Oh,
and,
yeah, I've been dealing with that shit lately.
Yeah, because I have a little NDA that's like 2 pages. It's one of these templates I got, and then I stripped out a load of crap from it. I just kept it really, really simple. You know, you tell me stuff, I'm not going to tell anyone. I tell you stuff, you're not going to tell anyone. Done, sign here. It's that sort of thing. Really, really simple. Because at the end of the day, NDAs are pretty pointless and crap, especially when most of the ideas
can't be legally upheld.
Yeah, you can't tell anyone about this. You can't tell anyone. Okay, sign the NDA. Right, what's the idea? It's like Twitter, but for kids. It's like, holy shit.
Someone came up with that idea 2 weeks ago and told me about it. So unfortunately, yeah, you've now breached their NDA.
Exactly. So anyway, so there's all this crap. So anyway, I get an email from this guy who does this flowery email. I found your site. I like the stuff you've done. I've got a social app. It's a bit like one of the ones you've done. Great. So that's a copy of that. So have you got, you know, I'd love to share with you the wireframes. Have you got an NDA? And I've got like a shortcut in Mac on my Mac, and in iOS, I can just type NDA link and it just pops in my Dropbox link.
Briefly before you carry on with this train of thought, if someone says that to me, I say my stock answer, no. And I'll say no. I need to qualify you a lot more before I'm willing to sign anything, even if it's my NDA. I'm not wasting my time with this.
Tell me your
app idea and tell me your budget, and I will give you a rough idea of how much this will cost. And then when we get into specifics, maybe I'll sign the NDA if I think that you're going to be worthy of being a client. But I'm not going to sign up for a query like that. I'd say no. But go on.
Yeah, well, I've got a pre-signed thing. It's just got a little squiggle on it. It's not even my signature. Don't tell anyone. You know, it's just a squiggle, but it's basically, look, it's a pre-signed NDA. It's a mutual NDA. That's the difference, because all of these ones that you get are all full of shit. So I send him this email, just said, look, here's my pre-signed NDA. Please send me the details and I'll have a look. He comes back saying, thanks for the quick response. Would you mind signing my NDA template attached? So I look at this template. It's about 5 pages long. It's been downloaded from some bullshit template service that's all legal speak.
Mine's Word NDA template.
Yeah. And it has the typical crap that they put in. First of all, it talks about the recipient being me, and everything was the recipient shall, the recipient will. Nothing says anything about them. It doesn't say anything about my rights or my ideas or anything being protected. So I respond, and it had this whole section on liability. You know, the recipient will indemnify, blah, 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 the client against, and it's like, no, 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 no. So I just responded with, look, I've given you an NDA. It's a simple NDA. It's a mutual NDA. It should be enough for us to have a professional conversation with. I'm not signing yours because it's loaded to one person, which is you. I literally said that. I appreciate the fact that you may want this signed. I totally appreciate the fact that you may not want to work with me if that's the case, and that's fine. I wish you well. So, you know, if I hear from you, great. I wrote it a little bit better than that, but basically didn't get a response.
I would have written it worse than that.
Yeah, and that was it. And that's fine. That's fine. I don't care, because I don't want to, you know, I've had work where I had this Internet of Things type project to do with, what the hell was it? A lawnmower, batteries, Bluetooth batteries for a company that does this sort of stuff, where they want to have an app that can pick up the Bluetooth battery and everything. And the contract had to be signed with a company in China, with their main company in China. And this contract comes back, and I'm just like, no, 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 no. I drop it into Google Docs and just strip out all of this stuff. Because one of it was, if anything happens during the project, we can stop the project. You have to give us everything you've done, and we can also demand a refund. It's like, no, that's not how this works. That is not how this works. See, why would I sign something that would destroy me?
No.
No.
That is one of the rare places where I would sign an NDA. So if you've got a company that's got a proprietary piece of hardware that they want you to use to build something, then it's like, fine, I'll sign any of that. But not just some kid off the street who's got an idea.
Yeah.
One of the funniest things I've had is someone that demanded me sign an NDA and went through this whole back and forth. And I was like, I'm not going to sign an NDA. And it went back and forth, back and forth. And then I finally, he sent me an NDA. I said, all right, send it through and I'll sign it just so we can get on with it. He sends me the NDA template with his entire idea and all of his wireframes. And it's like, well, now you've sent me all of that, I'm not going to sign your NDA. And he's like, what? I was like, well, you've already shown me to it. You've already indemnified it.
That is brilliant. The other one I love doing, which I really should have done with this one, actually, because it would have been fun, is sometimes when I get sent this stuff and it's like, you get someone who will send you a ridiculous contract or whatever, is I might actually just send back a signed version, but I've like stripped out everything. I've literally stripped out all of the stuff and then sent back a much shorter version that doesn't have any of the indemnification stuff. Exactly. And they'll go, oh, thanks for signing that. You know, you're just like, okay.
Or just add a few clauses. Add a few clauses, if I don't like the idea, you owe me £200.
I know. Or you will send me Smarties each week or something. But it's like, breach of contract. What do you mean, breach of contract? Yeah, where are my Smarties? Every time you turn up for a meeting, I want a tube of big Smarties. But yeah, I mean, this is the problem. This is the problem. Oh. You get people. And I think I said to someone once in an email, I actually, because sometimes you get in that zone when you're either in a mood or you've had a drink or whatever, it's the evening, you're fed up, you get an email coming and you might respond and be a bit more honest. I mean, you're obviously a bit more honest all the time. But so sometimes with one of these, I went back and said, I can sign an NDA, but let's face it, NDAs are pretty worthless. I think I actually said, NDAs are pretty worthless, and let's face it, an idea is worthless unless it's executed, you know, which is true. Absolute truth.
That's on my contact page.
Everyone can have an idea. It's worth shit unless you actually do something about it. This guy came back because what I do is I get these inquiries in, I pre-qualify, I do all the stuff I do. I stick them in a prospects folder, and then I have a service called Pipedrive I use to sort of funnel everything into different places so I know what's going on. And now and again, I'll go through that folder and go through that site and just, you know, respond to people, because I don't chase people. I'm not like a salesperson that gets a prospect in and then has to die to get that business. It's like, if you want to come back to me, great. If you don't, that's fine. You know, whatever. I'm not going to chase you.
Someone writes to you like a year later and they're like, oh, I wrote to you a few years ago about this. Can you still do it for the same price? And I go, my fees have gone up by about 50% since then.
I'll do one chase up where I might go, because I went back to them with like a budget or something, and I might do one chase up where I say, did you get this? I hope you got this okay. If you don't want to proceed, that's fine. I'll archive this and that's it. And then I don't contact them again. And that's that. That will be the normal way I do this. So I got, I'm trying to think of what I was going to say now, because I've totally forgotten my bloody train of thought. God, this is good.
Sorry, I interrupt you like a project manager.
Yeah, what was it about? It was people coming in with...
qualifying.
Oh, yes, right. So it was, this is good. This is good for the brain. So it was that. It was the email where I said an idea is worth shit unless you, you know, do something. Yeah. So I, about a week later or 2 weeks later or whatever, I followed it up and said, look, I'm not sure. Did you find someone for this? I just want to archive this if it's not of interest. And he went, yeah, we did go with someone else. To be honest, we were a bit put out by your initial email where you implied that our idea was worth nothing. I just replied with, okay, great, good luck. You know, it's just like, oh, people get so offended. But I think I mentioned this one before, about I think it was last year or the year before, I was walking the dog and I got this email through, because sometimes I'll check the emails while I'm walking. And this email came through and the guy said, and I've actually consciously now, which is annoying, I consciously go back and say thanks for the email, and then I go into my response. Because this guy I just went back with, he came in with an inquiry and I said, I could take a look at it, probably looking at a budget of this, this and this, whatever. And he actually responded with, well, a thank you would have been nice.
You know? Oh my God.
And I went, sorry? I just replied with sorry. And he went, I'm someone that's potentially giving you business, and, you know, thank you for the inquiry, or thank you for contacting me would have been a nice response.
Oh my God. I would not deal well with that. Yeah.
This is not somebody that I want to work with. You know, it's like,
Christ.
I don't react to when I get emails from someone, you know, if someone doesn't sign off an email with regards or doesn't put their name at the bottom or doesn't say hi, I don't get offended by that. It doesn't bother me. Do you know what I mean? It's just a communication channel. We're not falling in love with
anything. I get more offended if people do all that stressed.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things, a pointless meeting on the phone with the client, is they try and engage with small. You answer the phone and they're like, hi, this is Ben Dodson, developer. You're asking, oh, yeah, hi. How are you doing? Great. And then that's all I'll say. I'll just say, yeah, I'm good. And then I won't ask them how they are. I'll just say completely silent. And I've left that silence. I think 20 seconds is my longest. And then they literally go, so the reason we wanted to speak. There we go. We finally got to meet of the conversation. I don't have time for this shit. I don't give a shit how the weather is. I'm not making small talk.
You get that with agencies, don't you? You get that with agencies when you've got that 10 people in the room thing.
Oh, God.
You totally get that at the start of meeting. So how are you today? Yeah, it's really nice here. It's really sunny. We've got our party tonight. We're going to be going out. It was really cold yesterday. And it's just like, oh, my God.
Get on I'm with it.
Die. Yeah. So why are we here? I do love it.
See, I have for NDAs, I have a link that I sent to 2011. It's an essay called Why I Won't Sign Your NDA, which very succinctly points out why it's legally unenforceable, why it's completely irrelevant to your ideas, cases, and lists the times when it would be acceptable. And anytime someone asks for that, I say, sorry, I don't. I'm not getting into a legal contract with you. Here's an explains why. If you send me your app idea as like a basic paragraph or so, then I can give you some rough pricings, and then we can go from there.
What was I going to say? Yes, so, I mean, the point I'm trying to make about NDAs is if you do have to sign them or you do want to sign them, the key thing is that they should be a mutual thing. It shouldn't be like any contract. It should be fair. It should be, you know, about both parties. Because one of the things that can come up, I don't know what, you know, you probably sound like you're exactly the same as me in that, you know, you can talk to someone and be in a meeting with someone about their idea. And I've had a really cool inquiry recently from the council who wanted an app to do with getting people out and about and stuff. And they've got like a basic concept and they come to you and then you start saying to them, well, actually, it'd be really cool if you did this, or if you did this, you could add this, this, and this. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, wow, yeah, we didn't think of that. Well, those ideas are also important. And, you know, regardless of the fact about NDAs and enforcement and all that crap, you still should be looking out for those things, because at the end of the day, it's how many times have developers gone back with, you know, spec work concepts, spec work documents and proposals. This is why I never do proposals. You know, you do these in the old days, we used to do these 40-page e-commerce proposals for websites, which had all this technology talk and all this conceptual stuff and all this shit in there. I mean, it was very template driven, but there was some key stuff in about the deliverables that we were giving the client. But in those deliverables, you could be giving, you know, some UE designs and some concept designs. And that's stuff you're giving away that should also be protected, so that they can't take those ideas and those thoughts and then get someone else to do it and then put your ideas in. And then you find out your idea was the clincher that made that thing hugely successful. You know, chances are it won't. But all I'm saying is contracts should be fair and NDA should be mutual. And if anybody's giving me or anyone an NDA that is all loaded to them, then walk away, definitely.
Yeah, it's a tricky area. But as always, if you just say no, that generally solves most problems, I find.
But also, I mean, this leads us, I mean, not that we're on topic anyway, which is good. It's been a good one, actually. This leads me into a thing that I did have on the list, which is about freelancing development, which is about developers trying to sell what they do, not how they do it. I don't know how you feel about this, but yeah. I tweeted something about this because in the community that I'm in, you can get a lot of, well, it's not even just that, it's developers in general. You'll get certain developers who will jump about on different technologies. You know, they'll be on one thing. One thing is the greatest thing since sliced bread one day, and the next day it's not. And they'll jump about on different things just because they want to learn something else, or because it's super cool, or it's the hot new thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll do it to the detriment of the client because they'll be changing the back-end database from one thing to another. Why are you changing it? Oh, because this company pissed me off because they're charging £2 a month for it now instead of it being free and open source.
So they're going to migrate. Because they want to learn about it, and so they need an excuse to train up on it, so they do it on a client project rather than their own.
Exactly. And one of the classic things I get in my community, in the sort of Titanium community, is like, you know, how do you get work, and how are you able to get work, and how are you selling yourself and everything else? And my response is usually, I'm not selling myself as a X developer. I'm not selling myself as being that technology developer. I am selling a solution to the client of saying, in my case, I can give you a cross-platform native application. I don't say what I use. I do mention it on the website, but very few people read it. Some do, but very few people do, because they'll. I mean, I had one the other day that sent me a we've got an existing iPad app that we need some help with. And I'm like, well, is it written in Swift or Objective-C? Yeah, it's written in Swift. Okay, I can't help you, but I know someone who can. And, you know, it's that sort of thing. So I actually referred that to Luke because I know
you're looking. Thanks, Jason,
yeah.
You bastard.
but I know he was looking. I know he was looking, and they wanted to have a big, long phone call about it. And I said,
oh, okay, yeah. I'm not going to have that.
So, yeah,
you chose wisely.
My point is that I very, very rarely get a situation. It does happen, but it's very rare, where a customer will say, so what do you use? And I'll say, I use this. Oh, never heard of that. Or, oh, we've heard of that, but is it going to be able to do this, this, and this? It's very, very rare, because most of the time, they just want an app built, and they've got a budget, and they want iOS and Android, or they want just iOS and didn't realize they could have Android. Oh, great, we can have Android as well, because it's like 95% of the work done once I've done iOS. And that's the point is that, and my statement for that is, stop selling how you do it, and sell what you do, you know, what you deliver to the client. It's a bit like the value pricing stuff we've talked about before.
Yeah, I was going to mention that earlier on as well.
Yeah, that is the end thing. That's the end thing that you're selling to the client. I can give you high performance, you know, cross-platform, native app in the period of time you want for the price you want. That is what I'm selling. How I do it is irrelevant. And it's irrelevant for two reasons. One, because most of the time they don't understand it anyway. They just want the outcome. They might say, oh, is that a hybrid? And I'll go, no. Oh, great, because I didn't like hybrids. So that's because they might have heard something about that.
Yeah, but the other thing is, titanium.
But the other thing is, how many times, I mean, I know that you're like this, that you very rarely take on an existing app. But that's how a lot of developers are. It's actually a pain in the ass taking on an existing app and trying to understand the code base, and because developers do everything bloody differently, most of them. And 9 times out of 10, I get situations with clients where I'll say, okay, I could take this on, but I don't deal with that technology, but I could rewrite it to be this. And most of the time, to be honest, they'll go, well, actually, we could do that because we have been thinking of doing Android, or actually, it's been 2 years, so it could do with a redesign. A lot of the time, the client will actually, you know, I guess as a developer, you think, oh, well, I've got to develop this with this because it's going to give that client long-term longevity. Most of the time, the client will go, redo it.
This is a great example of not telling the client what you're doing. And this, I did this for the Great British Bcount app, which you did the first version of, and then I did the second, third, fourth ones. And the second version, I think I built in Objective-C maybe, or maybe Swift. And then when it came to the fourth version, they were like, how long would it take to do this? And I gave them a fixed price, said, I'll take this much to do it. And they're like, great, go ahead with it. And I completely rebuilt the app from scratch, and they never knew, because I didn't tell them, because they didn't need to know. But the entire app was rebuilt from the ground up, because it was cheaper and easier for me to do that. Now, if I'd gone back and said, oh, well, if you want me to add this feature, cost this, but I could rebuild it for this bit more, then they wouldn't have gone for it, because they wouldn't have wanted me to do it, because they wouldn't want to pay the extra. So instead, I just only gave them that option, but didn't even tell them that that was the case. And that's how I deal with a lot of these. So if people come and say, oh, I've got an existing app already, I just want to add these updates to it, instead of saying, oh, yeah, it's going to cost $2,000 to add those bits to your old app code that I really don't want to work with, I'll instead just say, yep, that'll cost $10,000, and just rebuild it. And sometimes they go, great. And again, they never know. I just they say, oh, do you need the old code? And I go, no.
Exactly, and that's the point. That's the point of selling what you're, you know, selling the value, selling the and selling outcome, what you're delivering.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly, the outcome. And as long as it's like the whole, you know, APIs and the way that, you know, business logic and refactoring works, you know, as long as the inputs go in and the outputs come out as they should, no one gives a shit what happens on the inside. You know, it's like the old thing about going through code, and, you know, if you're going to work on a new feature and you can see something that needs improving, well, improve it while you're there and make it more efficient or whatever. And it's easy to do that when you're refactoring, because, you know, the inputs and outputs stay the same. You just refactor the code inside. So I totally get that. And I would, you know, I would definitely do that for projects if I could.
No one cares how the sausage is made. They just want it to taste good at the end.
Exactly. As long as when they do their QA, everything works as it should. Where it goes wrong is if you do all that and then it goes, well, actually, we had a barcode scanner, or we had a camera feature. Yeah, I couldn't do that when I rewrote it. You did what?
Nothing. Yeah. You know? That has happened to me once before on an app that I think you're building the Android version of now, which was an app that I rebuilt for them, which they knew I was rebuilding. And then, like, halfway through, they're like, oh, what about this feature? And it's like, oh, what the fuck? I didn't know that was there. I should have looked at this in more detail. And I've had that before with... did an app for Calm Radio, and I rebuilt their app for them, which, again, they knew I was rebuilding it. But they didn't tell me all the functionality, and so I gave them fixed price, and I was redoing it. And they were like, it's not streaming to our Chromecasts anymore. I was like, what the fuck? And he's like, oh, yeah, if you've got a Chromecast in your house... when you use the app, it has a little Chromecast button, so you can stream to it like AirPlay. And I was like, ha, well, I don't have a Chromecast in my house, so I never knew that feature was there. And they were like, well, you looked at the app and told us you'd build everything that was in it. And it's like, yes, yeah. I did say that.
Yes, so I did
rush
do that.
To Argos and then had to rush to Argos and buy a 20-quid Chromecast. And then, I mean, it only took an hour or two to add it anyway, so it wasn't the end of the world. But you can get burnt by it doing that sometimes. But a lot of the time... I mean, you know, it's value pricing anyway. You just charge much more than it's actually going to take in order to offset in case that happens. So
yeah, exactly.
Which is, again, why, I mean, I need to update my website, actually. At the moment, I have a day rate on there, but I don't quote to people now in terms of days. Like, if someone says, oh, how long will it take to do this? I'll just say, that will cost, you know, £2,400. I won't say, that will take 4 days and I charge X amount per day. Because I also don't give them a timeline, because sometimes I'll say it'll cost that much and I'll have it ready tomorrow.
Right.
So I don't want them then going, well, how are you doing 4 days' work in 1 day? Because I happen to know very well how that'll work, and it would take another developer 4 days, so I'm charging that amount. So now I just charge fixed amounts, but I still like having a day rate on my website as like an indicative, this is roughly what you can expect. So it's more of a guideline I like to tell people. Where I won't necessarily stick to doing amount per day. Even explaining what a day is, it's not necessarily 8 hours. Sometimes it's 9. It depends. But I like having it there as a way of kind of saying, if another developer tells you that this is going to take 15 days, then this is roughly how much I'm going to charge you based on that, because this is how much I charge per day. It's like a good, it's almost like credit card APRs. Like, it's a good way of comparing between two things, even though I don't actually use that metric.
Yeah. So what? So I'm similar. So I went through a phase where I was charging based on a number of hours. So I would estimate the project. So it was like a fixed price because I was fixing the budget at, you know, 15, 20 grand, whatever it is. But then I take that number and I divide it by my hourly rate to come up with the number of hours. And then when I create the invoicing, I break it down into these chunks and try and break it down into like sprints, which is not really proper sprints, but it's sort of like sprints. They're really payment drops or whatever.
Yeah.
The problem that's easy to get into with that is that I've got to be careful how I say this, I suppose. Well, maybe not. the danger that you get is that you can be very efficient and you can get things done quicker, and you still want to deliver to that budget, because let's face it, what happens with this stuff is, even though you may have just done, you know, 4 weeks worth of work in 2 weeks and you're thinking, hey, quid's in, I'm 2 weeks up in terms of what I'm getting paid, chances are something's going to happen. Some unknown's going to kick in. Some problem's going to happen submitting. Some shit's going to happen, some redesign, some crisis. And all of a sudden that time gets eaten away really quickly. And it's usually, you know, you get 80% through a project and think, I'm making really good progress, and that last 20% is the absolute bitch and takes much longer.
Yes.
So what I started doing was still breaking it down into the chunks, but just not listing the hours anymore. So what I do now is I say, okay, it's going to be this much money, and I'm going to break it down into these payments, which are going to take place during the project. And sometimes I'll put dates on that if they want dates, and sometimes I'll just say it's going to be, you know, over a 6 weeks project, this is around the time I'm going to be sending that payment through or whatever, or that invoice through. But I don't equate it to a number of hours anymore. It's just
no.
And two things have caused that. One is that I've actually upped the pricing. I've gone sort of down the value pricing route, in the sense that instead of trying to calculate the hours based on experience, gut feel, previous apps I've done, I can pluck a budget out of the air and be pretty confident that I can deliver it for that. And cater for all of, like you say, cater for all of those things that can crop up. Because the problem with hourly pricing is that, and this is, if you read the Jonathan Stark stuff, if anyone is listening to this, first of all, if anyone is, thank you.
We know one person is.
Secondly, if you are, go and read up stuff that Jonathan Stark talks about value pricing, because it's really good.
Daily newsletter is very, very good.
Yeah, and he talks about all of the problems that happen with hourly pricing. And one of the classics is, and if you've ever hired a builder to do anything like that, then this is where this stuff happens, is that as soon as you've quoted for like a number of hours, you get into that mindset that as soon as the client comes back with, oh, could we tweak that or could we add that? You get into that whole conversation of, well, that's going to add more time or that's not on spec or that's off spec and we're going to need to budget extra for that. And you can end up having ridiculous conversations going back and forth, whether it's arguing or not, over what ends up being 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And yes, the argument is, well, all those 10 minutes adds up. But it's that whole concept of all of your time is you're tracking every hour of your time. And if the client calls you, I'm logging that half an hour because I need to show you that you're taking up my time. Whereas if you get rid of that mindset, and I've done this for a few projects now, where you do the value pricing type approach, you've priced it to the, you're pricing it in the budget that they're happy to accept. They are happy that you're going to deliver that solution for that much money and are willing to pay you that much money. They don't want to skimp or do anything. That's what they're willing to pay. You've met their requirement as long as you deliver it, yeah? If they then come back to you during that project, because you've taken less time than you might normally do if you're doing the hourly rate type work, when they come back to you with those little tweaks or little changes, it's okay. It's like, yeah, I could do that. Yeah, it's not a problem. You know, because you've factored that stuff in. The end result is you have a much better relationship with the client. And I've got that with a client in the States right now that I did a photo app for, which was a total value price project. And they came back to me recently. This is months after it's been submitted, saying there was a little issue with the sign up page. And instead of going back going, well, I'm going to need a prepayment of this much to deal with this and all that bullshit, I was just like, yeah, I took care of it, did the update, did a bit of testing, submitted it to the App Store. I don't mind because I've been, you know, I was paid enough for that project to be able to do that follow up for them. And the end result is they'll be much happier and then I'll probably get more work out of it.
Yeah, I've had that with a lot of clients lately, the same exact same thing where it's okay to do little changes afterwards because it's, you feel like you've got your money's worth out of them.
Exactly. And if you've got some, whereas if you've got, it's that mindset as a developer and as anybody that works on an hourly rate type thing, if you've been, and this is why you should never accept the jobs where you've been badgered down on price, you know, absolutely beaten down, because those are the projects that you end up not giving everything on because you're pissed off the fact that you compromised to take, and we used to do this in the old web days, you know, we'd end up for some crazy reason, you know, discounting down, you know, if we'd quoted 12 grand for a website and they had 10, oh yeah, we'll do it for 10. Well, immediately you've just undermined your entire credibility anyway, because you might as well work on a market stall. Yeah, you know, I'll do two for eight or whatever. And secondly, you're now pissed off because you've taken the discount. And those jobs are always the ones that go wrong. They're always the ones where that client will not only want you to knock you down on price, because everyone does, they'll then try. It's just like if you go and buy a car or you go and do anything. Oh, you know. I remember going to Tottenham Court Road and you'd say, you know, oh, what's your best price? You know, what's your best price? And then they'd knock down the price a little bit. Then can you throw in a case or can you throw in this? And it's like, oh, come on. You know what I mean? You've already been beaten down on price, so you're pissed off. And that's the stuff to avoid.
See, I'm a bit weird on that because I have a absolute zero tolerance policy on price discounts. I say it on my website, on my contact page. It's like, if you ask for a discount, I won't work because it shows me the type of client you are and I don't do that. But I'm also very fair in that the other way, I notoriously, my wife's dismay, never haggle with anyone about anything. If I'm buying a car, I will take the price and say yes. If I'm booking a venue for something or that's getting pretty a much quote for me, anything, I just go yes. Because I find that you get like a little bit of karma from that, so for example, I just bought a new car, as we sort of discussed a little while ago, and I didn't ask for a discount or ask for any extras or try and haggle with the price. They told me the price and I went, yep. And she was so surprised. And now I think that my car has been fast-tracked slightly because I was told like a date it was going to be ready, and it's going to be ready a lot longer, a lot earlier than it should be. And I think that because I didn't bother with the whole haggling and fucking around process, they, you know, you get something extra anyway without necessarily asking for it. And the same with, I had this recently, what was a really good example? I can't remember, but there was a situation recently where someone blatantly was expecting me to haggle with them and I didn't. And they were incredibly shocked that this was happened. Like, it's just like payment up front, done. The whole process is done. I think it was like a contractor or something. And the same with contractors. When I hire them, quite often I just pay them in full up front because it's how I like being paid. And so I won't like hold on to money for 30 days or do any that. If I'm hiring someone, you just pay them and be done. And you actually end up getting a much better result from people because they respect the fact that you didn't try and fuck them over.
Yeah, exactly.
In the same way that when I have a client that pays me up front, I try and do everything I can for them because I appreciate the fact that they haven't haggled, they haven't gone through that whole dance, and you get something from it anyway. And so sometimes it's better not to try and beat people down on price all of the time.
Exactly. And it's also like if you're working with a client where something's happened during the project and maybe you've fallen out, but there's something that's cropped up and you weren't fully aware of it, or you weren't fully aware of the issues around it, and the clients are you get that conversation with that, you said you'd do it for this price and you said you'd do it and I say you should do it and all this stuff. The problem with those sorts of relationships as well, when they get to that point is, and I said this to when we used to do web stuff, we had a couple of clients where this sort of happened. And I said, look, we can argue about this and you can beat me down on this and you can make me do this and I will do it to get the job done because we said we'd do the job, but we're screwing ourselves because we weren't fully aware of all these different things that could crop up. It wasn't our fault. There were some unknowns in there basically, and this has come up. So you can insist that we do this and you can push for it, but what do you think is going to happen next? When you come back to us for more work and you want more work done on this, what do you think is going to happen? Well, we're just going to up that price to make up for the damage that's been done before. And that's the other thing to consider. So it's like me bringing a builder in to do some work and I absolutely, nail them down on price and get them to add in extra things on my office and all this thing and absolutely screw them and then take ages to pay them and then bring them back in to do another job. What are they going to do? Well, they're not going to quote like they quoted before. They're going to immediately add a percentage on top because they know what I'm like to work with, or they could just say piss off. And this is the thing. It's like
treat clients in the way that you want to be treated, and generally you'll find that things work out. But in any case, we need to start wrapping things up because I've got to go
yes,
in a minute.
Yes,
but I did have one question for you before you finish, and that was: have any of your Alexas started laughing at you yet?
No. And I read something on that last night, and they said you can get her to do it by saying, can you laugh or something? And I did. And she just went, tee-hee, which I didn't think was very creepy. So
I've seen video of the laugh, and it is, I wouldn't say it was creepy, but I imagine it would be fairly sinister if you weren't expecting it, because it just happens apparently randomly. And it literally just goes, ha, like that. Also, it's really a bit weird. So I don't know if it's like a disgruntled employee or something who's been fired has added it in. That's my current guess.
That would be funny. That'll be very funny.
Apparently they're working on a fit, but
that's a shame.
Imagine just being in your room at night, like in your bedroom or something, and then Alexa just starts laughing at you. It'd be terrifying.
Yeah, that would be quite scary, actually.
I'm going to finish just with a brief thing about the HomePod, because my wife's absolutely loving it at the moment. She keeps asking her like to play different styles of music, like she said to it the other day, play me something with a bit of spunk in it. I was like, what are you expecting it to play to you? And I started playing the theme tune from True Blood, and she was like, yeah, that's about what I wanted. I was like, oh my God. But the other night, just jokingly, she said to it, she's like, Siri, play something to get me in the mood. And Siri just replied, and she went, don't mind me. And then just started playing Physical by Olivia Newton-John, followed by some Barry White. And we turned it off after we were laughing for. My wife said, bearing in mind we only had it for a few minutes, it would have been funnier if Siri had said when we said stop playing music, if she'd just gone, well, that didn't take long.
Yeah, now that would be good.